Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Undisclosed. This is Colin Miller, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Rabia Chowdhury. Rabia, how's it going?
I'm well. How are you, Colin?
Doing great. We are joined, and I'm thrilled to be joined this week, by Professor Valina Beatty, the Robert H. McKinney Professor of Law at the Indiana University Morris School of Law. Valina is a law professor, an innocence litigator, a former federal prosecutor. She was the founding director of the West Virginia Innocence Project. She was the deputy director of the Academy of Justice at Arizona State University, Sandra Day O'Connor School of Law. And in her various roles, she has exonerated wrongfully convicted clients, gotten presidential grants of clemency for drug offenses, and been an elected board member of the National Innocence Network. And so, Valina, thrilled to have you on the podcast.
Thank you, Colin. And I remember when I was in West Virginia talking with both of you about cases. So thank you for all your work for all this time and for really rising up these cases.
Yeah, we've mentioned you and I had some audio clips of you on the podcast before, and it's dealing a lot with this new book you have just published, Pink Crime, Fighting Against the Criminalization of Motherhood, Pregnancy, and Queer Identity. And Valina, as you note in the introduction, this is not just professional, and you're, of course, one of the titans in this field, but it's also very personal for you to have written this book. And what about your personal life informed your work on this book?
Yeah, so I wrote this book fairly quickly in the past few years when I moved back to my home state of Indiana. It's where I grew up. I came back to be with family, and I came back to grow my own family and have our daughter. But I am married to a wonderful woman. We are a queer couple, and we were pregnant moving back to this state. And we quickly realized that we were in a state that criminalized abortion in almost all circumstances. So if we were to have any problems with our pregnancy, and I had a pregnancy that was high risk for a couple of reasons, that we would not be able to get help in our state. And in fact, we would have to leave the state, and we made a plan to go elsewhere in case we needed to in order to get abortion health care. And then we realized that even giving birth in the state, that we could be targeted with allegations of fetal harm for our pregnancy behaviors, for simply being tracked as a queer couple having a child in this state. And then as the years have gone on, I've also found that Indiana is a state that, although we have a strong LGBTQ community in Indianapolis and in Bloomington, the state legislature has increasingly criminalized just the existence of being queer and particularly being trans in this state. So with all of those together and being a queer family now, I thought it was particularly important to lay out how this is happening and how this is leading to wrongful accusations against women who have miscarriages for fetal harm, who have stillbirths for murder, who have a child who has an accident or a shortfall, and then they're being charged with abuse. I thought it was interesting and important to really talk about all of that and how it's happening in our current environment in the framework of wrongful convictions, because then you can see exactly how prosecutors build these cases, how they're able to build a case where no crime occurred and convict someone. To hopefully, by us knowing those tools, we can stop it from happening on the front end.
And you trace this, and it goes further back, of course, but you trace all the way back to the Salem witch trials. And the topic you were just discussing, when we talk about junk science on the podcast, in the book, you talk about this floating lung test, which goes back centuries. And so can you tell our listeners what this floating lung test that is still used today seeks to accomplish and what it actually does?
Sure. And something I forgot to say is that the through line through pink crime is gender and gender expression being criminalized, that it's really women, femme presenting people who are being targeted and criminalized. And it's women who are being wrongly convicted where no crime occurred, that nearly 75% of exonerated women were wrongly convicted where there was no criminal act. And our history on this, as you say, goes back to the Salem witch trials and goes back to, you know, if you're alleged to be a witch, then how do you prove your innocence? you're innocent if when you're thrown into the water, you drown and you die. That's when you're innocent. But if you survive, then you're guilty and then the state kills you. So one form of science, or I should say of scientific evidence, that dates back, I mean, loosely, I think many forensic pathologists today would call it junk science, is this floating lung test that literally goes back hundreds of years. And it's this idea of how can the state prove, how can it be proven that a baby is born and is born alive and then is murdered? How can that be proven instead of that a woman had a stillbirth? And the solution is this floating lung test, where a piece of lung is taken from the baby, the fetus, and is put in water to see if it floats. Because the very simple idea is, if it floats, then that means that the baby was born, took its first breath, you know, breathed in that air into its lungs, and then was affirmatively murdered. I mean, horribly murdered, right? That's how we're deciding that someone is a murderer versus they had this tragic, tragic, tragic stillbirth.
And this is a test that's still being used today?
It is still being used today. In fact, the NAME, the National Association of Medical Examiners, there are members from there who wrote a letter this past year saying, this is so unreliable. This should not be used in cases. And yet, for example, Maura Akers in Maryland, she was convicted a few years ago based on the floating lung test. The Maryland Supreme Court recently reversed that conviction, saying that there's not proof that she murdered a child, instead that she had a stillbirth. And yet this evidence continues to be used. And it's incredibly faulty. And the worst part is that the piece of lung usually floats. So it usually shows, oh, the baby was born alive and the woman is a murderer when she's not.
Can you also talk about, I mean, so look, and we try to be an apolitical podcast, politically, there's been a lot of fear in the last few years that on the issue of like if a woman miscarries, which is such a common phenomenon for women who have experienced pregnancy. I mean, most of the women who I know who have experienced pregnancy have had a miscarriage in their lifetime, that can now bring murder charges. Can you talk about some examples of that and where this is happening?
Yeah. So up to 1 in 4 pregnancies can end in a miscarriage. Yeah. And it's not anything that the person who's pregnant, the woman, can control, right? It's a genetic anomaly. And yet we do have this messaging that, well, it's the woman's fault that she somehow caused it, that she somehow did something to lead to this miscarriage. And so we're seeing investigations, we're seeing legislation being proposed that women have to call the police if they have a miscarriage. We see national legislation being proposed that women who have miscarriages should use trap kits to trap their miscarriage and to have it in a container. I mean, like, so much stuff on micromanaging bodily autonomy and what is really very, very, very personal. And I'll just give one example, which is Patience Frazier in Nevada. She did not have many financial means. She did not have a working car. She's in rural Nevada. She's far from any clinic or healthcare. And she becomes pregnant and she's not getting prenatal care. And at some point in her pregnancy, she has a miscarriage. And she goes on social media and shows on social media that she's burying this fetus that she had named. And she says, you know, I'm so sorry. I'm a horrible person. And because of that burial, then police come and knock on her door and do a search of her property and dig up that burial ground that she had created. And when they first come in, she's like, what are you doing here? This is intensely private and personal. What's going on? But over the course of them interrogating her, of the police interrogating her, she starts to believe, oh, I must have caused this miscarriage. Well, how could I have done it? I ate a lot of cinnamon and I was lifting weights. And she literally confesses to causing the miscarriage through eating cinnamon and lifting weights. And that turns into criminal charges against her, to manslaughter charges against her.
In Nevada.
In Nevada. And so she ultimately, she pleads guilty because her attorney says, oh, if you plead guilty, you know, you won't get much of a sentence. Wrong. Yeah. Right? Because she's a quote unquote bad mom. So even though she has two other children, she's sentenced to a lengthy term. She goes to prison and someone finds her case, starts advocating for her. And it's only in post-conviction that she finally learns she did not cause the miscarriage. When she finally hears from experts who say, no, there's no way that that would have led to a miscarriage.
Wow.
And ultimately, her conviction was reversed. I do want to say her conviction was reversed. And she was granted compensation just this year from the state of Nevada.
That's horrific, though.
I am a perimenopausal woman, and like a lot of my friends who are in the same stage of life, our nights can be miserable because there is nothing worse than feeling hot and sweaty in the middle of the night. It disrupts your sleep, you're tossing and turning and feeling like garbage the next day. And I know it's a struggle for a lot of people, whether or not you are a perimenopausal woman. Well, that's where Orion Sleep comes in. Orion is a smart sleep system that fits right over your mattress you already have, and it adjusts your temperature to help you sleep. That's right, you do not have to buy another mattress. This is a system you put right on top of your existing mattress. It is totally personalized to you, and you and your partner can sleep at different temperatures to improve sleep. The science shows that your body temperature impacts your sleep quality, so getting the temperature right can improve your deep sleep, your REM sleep, and overnight wake-ups. Here's how it works. You set each side of the bed anywhere from between 50 to 115 degrees. While you sleep, the Orion mattress topper senses and measures how your body responds. And then Orion uses its sensors to improve your sleep more every night, so it gets better the longer that you use it. Look, I've been on a wellness journey for the last 10 years, and at the very center of it is making sure I get good sleep, especially the older I get. If I don't have a good night's rest, I can't get to the gym. I don't have the energy and the willpower to make myself the kinds of foods I should be eating. I just can't take care of myself, and neither can you. So get better sleep with Orion. Right now, Orion is offering our listeners 15% off at orionsleep.com/justice. That's orionsleep.com/justice for 15% off. Get better sleep backed by your own data at orionsleep.com/justice.
And Felina, we have all these issues you identify surrounding prosecutions in these cases of childbirth and miscarriages. And I know a few years ago, you and your wife, Jennifer Liva, you published an article regulating bite mark evidence, lesbian vampires and other myths of forensic odontology. And your thesis there was kind of the criminal legal system, the court system is not equipped to do this. We need to rely upon the expert community to kind of self-regulate. Is that how you feel about this field as well? Or do you think the courts can handle these types of issues you're raising?
I think it's an all hands on deck, you know, that we need change from every perspective, and we can rely on the courts. We can also rely on prosecutors to not be using bogus evidence, to really be looking into evidence before they're presenting it. We can look at public defenders asking for funds to have their own experts. But yes, I also think self-regulation of these different areas. So again, the National Association of Medical Examiners, the fact that they have, that members have come out with this letter specifically saying, listen, this shouldn't be adopted in courts, and forensic pathologists should not be using the floating lung test, to circle back to the floating lung test.
Right.
That's just one example where there is that self-regulation that can happen. It has not happened in odontology, in terms of bite marks and dentists. But I do think it's at least one avenue to really think about policing yourselves and trying to maintain integrity in your own profession.
And in terms of another field of what we would call junk science, and this is something where you have a shared interest and have discussed cases, and you discuss the case of your client, Tasha Shelby, in your book, and this diagnosis of shaken baby syndrome. And I have done my own work on the Michelle Healy case in New Jersey. Felina, what was your reaction late last year when the Supreme Court of New Jersey in the Nieves case, finally a state Supreme Court is saying this is akin to junk science. How did that feel? And what can you tell our listeners about the Tasha Shelby case?
That decision was so long in coming, and it reminded me that the New Jersey Supreme Court has been the first to stand up in eyewitness misidentification, right? Mm-hmm. When the U.S. Supreme Court wouldn't, the New Jersey Supreme Court did in Henderson. They've recently done even more on eyewitness identification, and yeah, that they issued this really crucial opinion on shaken baby syndrome saying, this should not be relied on to convict people of child abuse and of harm. And Tasha Shelby, I continue to represent her, and she continues to be incarcerated since her stepson tragically had a shortfall and a seizure and died almost 30 years ago. She's been in prison since 2000, and he collapsed and died in 1997. And she has served all that time, and she has always, always explained that she is innocent, and she's just done so much to support her community where she's incarcerated in Central Mississippi Correctional Facility, and yet the courts refuse to acknowledge that there is new evidence that shows she is innocent. In fact, the forensic pathologist who initially did the autopsy of her stepson, little Brian, and said, oh, this is a case of abuse, he retracted that. He changed the death certificate. So the death certificate now says the cause of death was accidental and natural. Literally, he changed it from, again, from homicide. He testified on her behalf in a post-conviction hearing. And yet the courts in Mississippi continue to say, this is not enough to reverse your conviction.
Wow.
And there's a lot of people who continue, I'll just say, to be prosecuted for shaken baby syndrome today. You know, today, like we just had this case reversed in Georgia. Just within the past few weeks, right? And then we have Robert Roberson, who he's on death row in Texas. So these cases, we may think that, oh, it's wrongful convictions we're trying to reverse from the past, but they're prosecutions that are happening today. And again, it's another reason I wrote this book. It's like, how can we impact these prosecutions that are happening today and stop them?
And all these shaken baby syndrome cases, right, they're the ultimate example of this 75% of wrongful convictions of women where there was actual no crime that occurred. And so I wonder, you know, we have a lot of listeners who want to see how can I help? And they're actually looking into wrongful conviction cases. From all your experience, how does working on wrongful conviction cases involving women differ from those involving men? What additional hurdles and obstacles have you seen over the course of your career?
The biggest hurdle is that they don't tend to be DNA cases.
Right.
So you don't have that, you know, winning ticket of, oh, I have DNA to say it's not Colin, it's Felina. And sadly, more and more courts are sticky about there has to be DNA evidence before I'll reverse a conviction. We have prosecutors who say, well, I'm not going to look into a case if there's not DNA evidence showing that the person's innocent. So this fixation on DNA is really too bad when DNA opened up that door to say, look, wrongful convictions are real. They actually happen. And yet now it's DNA that's closing that door and saying, oh, well, we're only going to look if we have DNA evidence that can prove 100% this person is factually innocent. Instead of looking at, oh, wow, here's all the problems that happened with this trial. Here's all the false evidence that was presented. Here's the police officer who lied on the stand.
DNA evidence cannot save somebody when a crime has actually not occurred. I mean, that's even a bigger issue, right?
Like, that's exactly right.
Right. And it's many of these cases, that's the issue, is that there has never actually been a crime at the heart of it. It's been some kind of tragedy that is then interpreted as a crime and criminal charges are brought.
Today's episode is brought to you by Vinted. If you are anything like me, you have stuff in your closet you have been looking at for years and never worn, thinking one day I'll either fit into it, it'll be the right occasion, or I'll be in the mood for it. Well, look, if a couple years have gone by, it's time to get rid of that stuff. It is time to do a closet refresh. That is what I did this summer, along with my daughter, who went off to college because I was like, nope, you are not leaving your closet looking like that. And we used Vinted to do it. Vinted is a secondhand marketplace app with a mission to make secondhand your first choice. Whether you are clearing out pieces you no longer wear or if you're finding unique items at great prices, Vinted makes it simple to refresh your wardrobe, earn extra cash, and give your clothing a second life. Plus, with no seller fees, you keep what you earn from every single sale. Vinted helps their members find great deals and easily sell the clothes that they no longer wear, giving quality items a second life again and again. Vinted makes the process so easy. The app is free to download and there are no seller fees. Listing items on Vinted is quick, it's simple, and when an item sells, guess what? Vinted even creates a prepaid shipping label just for you. So if you are ready to clean out your closet and make some extra money, download the Vinted app for free and start listing. With no seller fees, you keep every dollar you earn, and your clothes get a second chance at life.
You also, one of the cases that you talk about in the book is about a teenager who's queer who takes a photo of a child's diaper rash at work and ends up with a sentence of 126 years. Can you talk about that case? And in that particular case, I want you to talk about like why the identity of this defendant was central.
So that is Rose Berline Turin. And for folks, to your point, Colin, who want to support a case or a person who's being charged, Rose Berline Turin currently is having a hearing, post-conviction relief hearing in November, and she needs support. She needs people to know about her case. Her attorney is at the Maryland Office of the Public Defender's Office, and it's just him working on it. And anyone who can provide some support for her case, I think would be very welcome, and just bringing more attention to her case and the atrocity of it. So Rose Berline, 19-year-old Haitian Black young woman, in Western Maryland, so in a more rural part of Maryland, actually close to West Virginia, where I used to live. And she was a daycare support person. So she was one of the assistants at a daycare. So one thing that she did was if she was changing a baby or a toddler's diaper and they had extensive diaper rash, she would take a photo of that for her boss to give to her boss. Long story short, those photos end up being, you know, talked about to the police, to prosecutors, and prosecutors bring charges of child pornography against Rose Berline, that she took those photos for sexual gratification. Now, that's just a complete yes. stretch, because there's nothing here to show that. There's not any distribution of the photos. She didn't send the photos, not even to her boss. So she wasn't sending them. Police took her phone and she had 145,000 images on there. And none of them were of children, except for the diaper rash photos. She didn't have a history of inappropriate behavior.
How were those pictures even discovered, though? What happened that anybody even knew that she took the photos?
It was someone she worked with who saw that she had the photos on her phone, which, you know, yes, she should have deleted the photos, but it was someone she worked with who ended up reporting her about it. Okay. And why did they report her? And why did prosecutors bring these charges?
Right.
Because Rose Berline is a queer woman. Mm. And she was pretty open about that she was queer. She was questioning. She didn't know if she was bisexual, if she was a lesbian. And that was the hook for the prosecutors to say, oh, she intentionally took these for sexual gratification because she's queer. So that builds on one of the oldest tropes in the book, that queer people are sexually dangerous, sexually deviant, and that we can be harmful to
pedophiles.
And we're not, and queer people are not. In fact, you know, the most likely people who are going to harm children sexually are straight white men. Mm-hmm. And we can think of multiple examples in the news these days of that. I don't mean straight white men, straight men in general, but I was thinking of one person in particular. So Rose Berline goes to trial and she testifies. She gets on the stand and the prosecution brings out that she's queer and then argues that in the closing, that wow. to the jury that that's the connection. That's what shows that she took these purposes. She took these photos with a purpose, a sexual gratification. And on top of this, so the jury convicts her and then the judge sentences her to over 120 years in prison.
My God. It feels so archaic.
She's 19 years old and her life is gone.
Wow.
Yeah.
So she's currently have a post-conviction hearing is upcoming.
Yes. So okay. The Maryland Supreme Court affirmed her conviction narrowly. There was a strong dissent, but the Maryland Supreme Court said, it's true. Not all photos of children are pornography, but these were.
Now, Valina, in the book, you know, I think a lot of listeners from our various series see how the prosecution and the police often work in lockstep, and sometimes there's intentional misconduct, sometimes there's tunnel vision. But you have a section in your book, and you tie it to the Melissa Lucio case, which has been very much in the news, and you explain how in this realm of pink crime, we often have these collaborations among doctors, social workers, and police producing these wrongful convictions. Kind of explain to our listeners how this collaboration works and how it produces these no crime, often wrongful convictions.
Right. And Melissa Lucio is a prime example of this. She was on death row, I believe maybe the first woman on death row or maybe the first Latina on death row in Texas. And she had a number of children. She was pregnant with twins and her toddler fell down a steep set of stairs. Tragically, her toddler died at the hospital. And then within hours of that child's death, the police take Melissa into custody to interrogate her overnight for hours, again and again, saying, you must have abused this child. You must have caused this. And there's a couple things that can happen here with a connection with medical professionals. One is that police can use statements by doctors, statements by nurses to elicit a false confession, to say, nope, it must have been abuse because this is what the forensic pathologist said. This is what the emergency room doctor said. This is what the nurse said. So it must have been abuse. You must have harmed this child and killed this child. So that's one way. Another way is simply from medical professionals connecting with social workers when there is some concern about, you know, a child who's at the hospital. And those social workers then connect with the police. So we have the police investigating something that could just be, you know, a child is born and has some kind of health condition. And instead it turns into an investigation of, well, what were your pregnancy behaviors? What did you do as a mother to cause this harm to this baby? Were you walking enough? Were you not on bed rest? What were you eating? Like it goes right back to how is the mother accountable for this? And how can we use the family policing system to separate these babies from their mothers? And how can we use the criminal legal system to punish these women for being quote unquote bad mothers? And Melissa Lucio ended up having what we were talking about, faulty bite mark evidence that was used against her, that these allegations that she bit her toddler, which was totally false and thrown out ultimately. She had a false confession where she finally was like, I don't know what you want me to say. And so she took responsibility for what happened with her daughter when she had done nothing to lead to her daughter's death. And again, we just see this confluence of medical providers working with the police leading to this wrongful conviction.
The older I get, the more I want to simplify my life. I want quality over quantity. And that's why over the last couple of years, I've been collecting pieces in my closet that I find myself reaching for again and again. You know, classics. The sweater that somehow works with everything. The jeans that you know always fit just right. Or that bag that you carry everywhere. Those are the pieces that earn a permanent place in my wardrobe. And that's exactly what Quince does so well. Quince makes elevated everyday essentials using premium materials like Mongolian cashmere, organic cotton, and washable silk. The designs are timeless. They are thoughtfully crafted, and they're made to be worn again and again. Their 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters start at just $50, giving you the softness and quality that you would expect from a luxury brand without the luxury price tag. Quince also has premium stretch denim, and that is the only way I will wear denim, by the way. They've got beautiful leather bags and footwear and gorgeous 14-karat gold jewelry that can be the finishing touch that pulls an entire look together. I spent my whole summer in their elegant linen pieces, and now that our favorite season, fall, is just around the corner, I can't wait to pull out Quince's cashmere sweaters from my closet so I can look classy and feel cozy. And by the way, Quince doesn't just have apparel. They even bring that same approach to everything they make, you know, timeless, beautiful, classy pieces, from hotel quality bedding and bath to kitchen essentials and thoughtfully designed furniture. They make well-designed pieces for everyday living. So find the fall pieces you'll reach for most at Quince. Download the Quince app for app-exclusive offers or go to quince.com/towardjustice. Once again, that's quince.com/towardjustice. You get free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada and the UK too. That's quince.com/towardjustice.
I kind of want to pivot a little bit to a case that we've been talking about for the last couple of weeks on our Unfiltered episodes, and that is, it's dominating the news right now. It's the Lindsay Clancy trial. Now, in this case, you know, there's no argument about whether or not Lindsay Clancy actually killed her children. You know, the defense is arguing that she's not criminally liable for the murders of her children because she experienced postpartum psychosis. And you were mentioning before we got on the air that you have an article coming out, or perhaps you've published it, excuse me if I'm wrong, that talks about a story in your family that also has to do with some postpartum difficulties of one of your relatives. Can you talk a little bit about that? And I want to see like kind of how it ties into this case that's like just taking over everybody's algorithms right now.
Yeah. And I'm actually really glad that so many people are talking about Lindsay Clancy's case and are saying, why is the state punishing this woman by trying to get a sentence for her, send her to prison? Like, why is that the response? Yeah. Why is criminalization the response for Lindsay Clancy for this horrible, horrible tragedy? And I have an article that's coming out in the UCLA Law Review called Reproductive Wrongful Convictions, The Making of Unfit Mothers. And what started me working on that article was both, you know, the investigating of how the state is surveilling and controlling and using the legal system to punish women, to incarcerate women, and my own personal history, where my great-grandfather's first wife, Fanny Blair Price, they were married in the early 1900s in Indiana. And within a year of their marriage, they had their son. And then after Fanny had her son, she started behaving differently. My great-grandfather started saying that she would be happy, and then she would be sad, and she would be crying, that she would have these mood swings. And within, again, a year of her son being born, my great-grandfather, Thomas Price, had filled out a statement alleging insanity against his wife. He had filed this statement. It's a medical legal document where he answered questions about, is she mentally fit or is she unfit? Mm. He, as a layperson, as her husband, right, in that kind of power position, he fills out this document, submits it to the court, and the court issues a warrant for Fanny's arrest. And so sheriffs come to the house and they take Fanny and they involuntarily incarcerate her. And the story in my family was she was insane and she spent the rest of her life in this mental institution in Indiana. And I'll just say I was additionally interested in this because Indiana was the first state to pass a eugenic sterilization law mandating sterilization of people who were labeled unfit. Mm. And so I wondered if Fanny had been forcibly sterilized because of being locked up that way.
She died in that facility then.
So that was what my family always said. Mm. But here's the hopeful part. She actually, when I was going through these records, she actually was released within 2 years. Okay. Because she may have had postpartum depression. She may have had postpartum psychosis even. And yet, even in that facility, they recognized that, oh, she does not need to be here. And so within 2 years, she was actually released. Mm. And she moved to a different county, Vigo County in Indiana, and she married a farmer and hopefully like live the rest of her
Good
life.
For
but
her.
I will tell that is great. Yeah. I will tell you, she was not reunited with her son.
No.
Her son was taken away from her, raised by my great grandfather and by his own mother, and they were not reunited. Like, she was labeled as unfit, and that label stuck with her. But I think it's an important story to be talking about now, about how women are just discarded if they have mental health issues. So many women have postpartum depression, and then a few have postpartum psychosis. And where can they go? Where can they get help before a tragedy like this?
I mean, that's, you know, and in this particular case, what we see is that Linda Clancy tried for a very long time in every single way possible to get help. So it's not even a case in which, like, you know, she neglected to try to get help for herself, for her children, her family. And that takes me to the question of what is a person to do then? Like, so for example, if a woman miscarries, and sometimes women miscarry not even knowing they're pregnant, this happens as well. But should a woman go underground when she realizes she's pregnant, not get maternal care? Because once you do that, then you're on the radar as actually being pregnant. Should you stay underground until, I mean, like, it is a terrifying reality for people who are experiencing pregnancy to say, like, what, you know, what if something goes wrong? So should I hide the pregnancy? Should I get maternal care? What do you do in this situation? I don't, like, what do you suggest then as, you know, somebody who might be vulnerable? Population are vulnerable to this kind of criminalization. How do they protect themselves?
Yeah. So this is all about control. It's all about the state being able to surveil and control women and women's bodies. And for people who are potentially considering abortion health care, not to talk about that, because we know that our texts, our DMs will be turned over to the police and can be turned over to the police and then can be used against you in building a case for having obtained an abortion or for fetal harm. In terms of getting prenatal care is the gold standard to be able to get prenatal care. We also have prenatal deserts across the U.S. where you can't obtain that care. And we also know that lack of prenatal care, prosecutors turn that against women. So if they do have a miscarriage or a stillbirth, well, why didn't they get the prenatal care? Is because they were intending to harm the fetus, that there was this intent to harm the fetus, which, again, is such a stretch. And yet prosecutors try to convincingly argue that because someone didn't get prenatal care, that meant that they murdered their baby when they had a stillbirth. So again, I would say keeping your information as private as possible. Also, state hospitals are more likely to be turning over information, more likely to be collaborating with the police than private doctors are. Private doctors tend to protect their patients more.
Wow.
And in the piece in your book, you also write about, in this realm, the use of AI health algorithms and looking at what constitutes an at-risk pregnancy. And you sort of signpost and say, like, there are concerns here about AI and how that could be used to prosecute women in connection with childbirth and motherhood. And so can you kind of share your thoughts about this brave new world and how AI might be a new area of trouble in criminal courtrooms?
One thing that AI can do is just collect all that data and synthesize it very quickly and go through all that information very quickly, which includes being able to go through app information. If you have a period tracking app, that period tracking app would be able to say, oh, you did not get your period this month. Having that as evidence that, oh, this woman did know she was pregnant, when again, she may not have, Rabia.
Right.
To your point. But those health apps that we have on our phones are data that can end up being not just turned over to police, but really combed through and synthesized through AI. Again, building this case, because what the state's trying to do is establish intent, that you intended to cause some kind of harm. And I say that even though we know there are other cases of fetal harm where the state doesn't need to actually prove intent. They just need to establish that, for example, a woman took a controlled substance and was pregnant. And if you took a controlled substance when you were pregnant, even if it was prescribed to you, that can be an allegation of fetal harm.
You've written about so many areas of junk science, a few of which we've touched upon today. So we have outdated and always faulty arson science that's been discredited, bite marks, which we discussed, shaken baby syndrome, everything that is discussed here in Pink Crime. You mentioned self-regulation in the article on bite marks. Some states have passed or are looking into junk science statutes. What do you think is the best fix here, if there is one, to regulate junk science overall and then specifically in the space of pink crimes?
So within the agencies, I definitely believe that crime labs should be disclosing scientific evidence and lab work evidence equally to the defense and to the prosecution. And we have an example of that with the Houston Forensic Science Center that just has a portal. These labs have portals where they upload their findings, they upload their work, and they share that with prosecutors. So why not just share it directly with prosecutors and defense? If you're saying this is upstanding, impartial, unbiased scientific evidence, then share it equally with the defense and the prosecution instead of only giving it to the prosecution, and then the prosecution decides whether to turn it over, whether they need to turn it over or not. So that's one thing within the system. But external to the system is social pressure. We have elections this fall for prosecutors, and our head prosecutors are elected positions. And this is so local and so important and so often just flies under the radar. But your prosecutor decides whether to prosecute women for miscarriages, whether to bring charges against someone who has a ID that doesn't match their gender presentation, right? Their ID says male and their gender presentation is as female or as femme. It's the prosecutors who decide whether to bring those cases or not. So if there is no political vocalization, if there are people saying this is not our priority, we want you to focus on domestic violence, for example, this is not our priority, then that can really make a difference.
Thank you for bringing that up, because I rail about that all the time, that the power of the prosecutor is greater than the power of the entire system sometimes. And so, but most people have no idea who their local elected officials are anyways, and don't realize how important that is. In the kind of the same vein of that question is, I mean, you know, your work is mostly looking kind of at post-conviction remedies, right? Like in these situations, what are the remedies when the defense here is like, this is a conviction or a prosecution based on identity? You know, like how do you prove this? And if you're even able to prove it, is it a so what in the post-conviction stance? Like, what do you do with that?
Well, it has historically been kind of a so what, where wrongful convictions litigators put into petitions like, hey, there was racial bias, there was gender bias here, and they add it in. Right. They're saying, here's these other things going on, but we're adding this in as well. And there's been some success with cases like in Boston, in Massachusetts, where courts have recognized those as claims. But as Colin well knows, because he's written about it, the Brenda Andrew case, Andrew versus White, Supreme Court case 2025, where the U.S. Supreme Court has said that it violates the Constitution, violates due process, if the prosecution is just putting on evidence that's about gender bias, that you're a bad wife, that you're a bad woman, that you're a bad mom, that, you know, evidence... Bad widow, evidence of, you know, here's these explicit texts that you had with some lover, or here's, talking about Brenda Andrew case, here's this book that she has, like, here's you know, 500 ways to drive a man wild. Mm. Why is that evidence in a case? It's not. Right. It has nothing to do with the criminal act that is charged. And I appreciate that Colin has raised that this is both an argument at trial in terms of evidence and should be excluded as evidence under our rules of evidence. And it is also post-conviction. It is a way to go back into those convictions and say, hey, the Supreme Court, our Supreme Court has now officially declared that this violates due process and that this person's conviction should be reversed.
This reminds me of many of the post 9/11 terrorism convictions. I remember going to a trial of a young man, and a lot of these proceedings happened in the Fourth Circuit, which was not too far from me, and sitting in the courtroom as the prosecutor put on evidence that this young man owned a certain book. And I was like, wait, I own that book. I have that book at home. And so, yeah, it's again, identity-based prosecutions.
Absolutely. And they coincide also with moral panics.
Sure.
Like there was that moral panic in that moment post 9/11. Mm-hmm. And then that we have a moral panic now as well.
Can we call it immoral panic? I feel better about it.
Sure.
That.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I wonder, Valina, in terms of this topic of pink crime, without disclosing anything now, I spent the better part of my summer researching how women have been treated in petitions to conviction review units. And it's part of a submission I just filed yesterday, actually, in a wrongful conviction case to a conviction review unit. And I'm hopeful. And my research has made me hopeful, although, of course, you vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. But how hopeful or pessimistic are you about conviction review units being a good body to hear these pink crime cases as opposed to the courts?
I am hopeful about that. I mean, I know that there's, you know, CRINOs, conviction review units in name only. But I actually am hopeful because I know about conviction review units that really are looking and are also looking not just for can this person prove innocence with DNA, but was there something really wrong with the prosecution? Was there false evidence? Was there police misconduct? That's what they're looking at. So Detroit, for example, Wayne County, right? Their conviction integrity unit really looks at this. Minnesota, their statewide conviction integrity unit. New Orleans Parish. These are all examples of conviction integrity or conviction review units that actually, again, are not just looking for the easy, is there DNA? But instead are looking at what did we do wrong and do we believe in the validity of this conviction and the validity of our work? Can we uphold it? So I'm delighted to hear about this research that you've done, Colin, and I think it could be quite persuasive.
I don't want to say yet because I don't want to feel like the CRU, you know, I'm putting them on blast. They asked for my students and myself to do a submission, and we just submitted it yesterday. And so hopefully, in the near future, I'll be able to update you on the status of that submission. All right, so wrapping up, listeners, I very much strive, my highest recommendation to Valina's new book, again, it is Pink Crime, Fighting Against the Criminalization of Motherhood, Pregnancy, and Queer Identity. Valina, is there anything else you can share about the book that our listeners might want to hear when they're making that decision about whether to purchase it?
I hope that you see that the book not only is relevant to our current time, but is a way with ideas for us to be our own change makers. The whole last chapter is really about ways that we can change things and ways that we can make a difference and ways that we can help people who are currently being targeted and prosecuted. So I hope that if nothing else, people will look for that final chapter on what they can do. And also you can find me on social media, on all the socials, Valina Beatty or Valina Beatty Author. And I'd love to hear from folks. So if you've had your own experience or you know someone, I really would love to hear from you and to talk about it.
Once again, the book is Pink Crime, Fighting Against the Criminalization of Motherhood, Pregnancy, and Queer Identity. It's being published by thenewpress.org. You can find it on that website under the new releases. Valina, thank you for joining us. And do you have a website, by the way?
I do. ValinaBeattyJD.com.
Great. Thank you so much. And I'm sure that's a way people can reach out to you as well. Thanks for all the work you do. And thanks for joining us after all these years. It's been great to have you.
Yeah, thank you.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners. It's Meethal, executive producer of Undisclosed Toward Justice. Before I roll through the credits, I've got a few quick notes. By now, most of you probably know about our Facebook community group. If you haven't joined yet, please go to facebook.com/groups/towardjustice and answer 3 simple questions and you're in. But seriously, answer the questions because a bunch of you are still pending since you've only answered 1 or 2. They're easy questions, I promise. In addition to engaging with us through the Facebook group, you can also leave us a voice note at speakpipe.com/undisclosed. We always check the messages, and so far, I think we've answered all of them. We also have a Patreon page with 3 different tiers of perks, the lowest one just being $1, which allows us to continue to do this work. Other tiers include bonus episodes, early access to merch, and even joining Rabia in a live true crime Zoom discussion. Just go to patreon.com/undisclosedpod. Now, onto the real credits. A huge shout out to Hannah McCarthy for audio production. Thank you to Patrick Cortez and Romero Marquez for our theme music. For anyone new here, you can engage with us online by going to Instagram or Facebook at Undisclosed Podcast. We're also on TikTok, YouTube, and X at Undisclosed Pod. Whether you're a new or returning listener, you can always check out our previous cases and bonus episodes by going to our website at undisclosedpod.com. If you would like to follow Colin and Rabia on social media, you can find Rabia at RabiaSquared2 on Instagram and Colin at EvidenceProf on Instagram, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you all for your continued support and for supporting all of our sponsors. Until next time.